from Germany, our homeland, away from Brussels, at home, Aide Hinrichs spent the last 10 months in Florence, fellow artist at Villa Romana, where we got to know her and a subtle language of uncertainty and joy, where we approached an interest in interpretation of literature and a use of the experimental text dictée by Korean-American artist Teresa Ankyun-cha as its source, being one part of her work a literal translation and a second part a translation into sculptural works. Let's start from the act of translating, from the confines and the ground of visual and literal translation.
I think that the moment of translation is the moment where you have to be true to the text. Still, every translation is an interpretation. You have to reinvent the text, but at the same time, it requests you and asks you to be very, almost to try to be the other person. And to understand their process, their motivation, their emotions. And that's the moment where I'm true, but in the moment I go into a visual part or a sculptural expression, I liberate myself from the immediate translation. Then I rather use it as a source, as a base, as a point I leave from. And it's also the results are living clearly by themselves. They are not tied. There's a new work that comes out of that. But at the same time, I think that especially in the work connected to dictée, the role I choose is like to give the text opportunity or the chance to live another life, to prolong its existence. And at the same time, the dedication you offer to the text is a moment of, since the text is a text that offers, it's telling the story of an experience of exile over three generations from the woman's perspective in one family, I would interpret it as a process of healing and of mourning, of course, but it's a continuation of that process, of the healing process. So in the end, I choose someone to follow. Yeah, and even it's following a text, and it's not an ending story. The story has a circular structure, so it's maybe an endless story or an endless text. The book was recommended by a friend to me, and I was searching for English literature that uses images and text next to each other, where the images or documents have an equal quality next to the text, where they are not illustrating or, yeah. And I was, before reading, worked with the text also that's by Sebald, and there this practice is also present. So then this book was handed to me, and it took me quite a while to start to read it, and in the end, it was in the moment I left Seattle in the airplane where I read it for the first time, where I couldn't escape the text. I had to sit for 9 hours in the flight, and it was the perfect moment.
And she had already been working with Sebald. She knows both texts very well.
The uses in dictée are, the text is very different than Sebald's text. It's much more experimental, and the variety of documents are larger, so you have not only photos, you have handwritten texts, you have diaries, you could say it's much more found documents than it is purely imagery that is used, and you have poetry quotations that are not identified, so it's a very, I would say, like you would say, that's a postmodern use of text. And Sebald is a narration that starts and that ends, and you have text that runs through. So, but interestingly, the idea of a circular structure and the idea of a narrator the narrator and the second person, the listener, the conversation is happening through, is a motif that you can find in, not in the dictée text, but in other works of Teresa also. And but the circular structure that is inherent in Austerlitz is also part of the dictée structure. Interesting is like that in the images Sebald chooses, the place and architecture is much more present than it is in the dictée. Teresa Hacking-Char's choice is, I think, it tells you much more about a personal trace, about that gives you an idea of a generation. It's a portrait or it's a specific person, and you can identify this person somehow. And it's a personal handwriting. In that sense, it almost feels like it's much more static, or it is talking about a... I think the imagery is creating a time frame, and in Sebald's, it is trying to give you a sense of place.
What seems a common feature of both books is the sense of an in-between space, of suspension. It is interesting how this moment of uncertainty is also present in Hinrich's work. And a recent video from 2013, Shivers, reminds us of that space. A hand shivers, suspended in a fragile repetitiveness.
In both texts, there's the idea of the tension is the knowing that there is incredible pain. Then this pain has not a place, or it is not located, or the work and the writing is done to give this pain a place and to identify it and to tell or to create that memory and to give it in space and time a concrete place. But it's always the question of, in both cases, like, how can you bear that pain and how do you deal with that in a physical aspect? And the hand is the part of the body that reaches always into different spaces. It's the place that is most, or the part of the body that is reaching out into maybe these spaces that are not yet described, or you are about to enter, or you are like, it's maybe a little bit in front of you. And that is like the way why I choose this moment of insecurity, or it's also a moment independent now from the context of dictée or Sebald text, like that the moment of creation, or the moment something comes into existence, is a moment where you and every artist is extremely vulnerable and you have to leave control behind and you reach out into a space you don't know. And it's, in the end, I think it's each time a risk, and somehow this is a risk that is has to be held by the artist, but as much also by the surrounding, or by the outside. You see someone suffering maybe, or enjoying doing these steps. And this is kind of, that video is maybe a description of that.
Ida Hinrichs uses a playful array of materials and objects. Papier-mâché, among the others, serves to mold sculptures resembling body parts, arms, legs, ears, tongues, bricks, and punctuation marks.
Papier-mâché is a material I use a lot. It started like in a way that I created a three-dimensional alphabet, and it was from newsprint. And so there was the idea to form an alphabet that has, so to say, a three-dimensional quality, that is not like all written language is normally two-dimensional and is flat, so to give that a space, really, and to relate maybe to the space that a spoken word occupies in contradiction to that, what is in the flat space of a printed page. in between there were many steps, but one was also, and that was in the exhibition Echoes in Heidelberg, that I used paper mache with parts of clay inside to build bricks. To form bricks, and there was form of a leftover, you wouldn't know if it's a ruin or something that broke down or comes further into existence. So it's a part of a space, an unfinished space, or a space that is breaking down. But the idea was to build something, and that's somehow, it has a structure like a text maybe has. And in combination with these bricks, there were feathers, as they are like parts of the bird's dress. But at the same time, they're the tools you would write with. And it's about the different spaces that you create around your person, or as like you have this, the body that is either dressed with fabric, but a bird's body is dressed with feathers. Then you have the architectural space, but you have also a space that is created by text. And then most recently, these forms are parts of bodies, so you almost, the first ones were just used again with the same structure of paper mache and clay, dried and then polished, so that they became a very smooth surface, but there were imprints of hands inside. It's in the end about the interaction or the connection between several individuals, and it's about the force that is enforced onto bodies in a very literal way. So you have marks on these body parts. And these imprints, I first of all used them on drywall, so more on like more the way the video is also done, that it's reaching out into a space like outside of the body. And so this is a reverse movement, like not reaching, not describing the space around you, but describing the traces of interactions or forces that are drawn onto the body. The part where I'm not sure where that is leading to is kind of using the paper mache in combination with more clay and firing them, so that through the process of the fire, the paper is burning away and you get a very porous surface, and you have the traces of the fingers, but at the same time you have the paper that disappears, so you have a very porous material that ends.
Porosity. It is not just an aesthetic feature or a matter of texture. It is above all the ontological dimension of the experience she creates, questionings with her objects, our body relation to the space.
The understanding of the space is not a static one, and it's described as a temporary unit and as something that is also only in existence for a particular time. So it's not a statement, it's not an object also like that will last forever. It is inherent in the material that it won't last forever, but it's also inherent into the idea how the sculpture is built, that there are, as you said, the feathers are there in the little holes and there in the gaps, and there is transition built into the material or into the forms and objects. And it's more an idea of playing with the limit of where does something come into existence and where is it disappearing. And it's also confronting, I think, the person who is seeing or encountering with the fragility and with like this moment of knowing that it's not. It doesn't confirm the idea of an static idea, and that I think can be also very uncomfortable.
sculptural vocabulary is also composed of punctuation marks. What remains of a text, of its content, of its ability to communicate, is only a meaningless structure. The rhythm is turned into silence, into a pause.
Wait, I think that that all punctuation, it gives the rhythm to the text, but at the same time, it creates a structure. It shows you where something ends and where something starts, where you might breathe. Of course, I use them also in this space to create a structure, but in the end, it's almost something like a request for a break. So you have this moment of the hand that is shivering constantly in the space. Constantly, there's no stop. It's running and running. It's shivering and shivering. And in the end, it's either it's a request for a break, or it's the statement that you need at a certain moment a rest. So, okay, the origin of these punctuation marks is from the very starting point of the dictate text, where she, that's a scene where she describes how she comes into a new place.
Open paragraph. It was the first day, period. She had come from afar, period.
And as the person who is from far, far away, and there's almost this expression of that, the scene means like there is not the possibility to describe how far you are.
Tonight at dinner, comma, the families would ask, comma.
All the punctuations in this text or in this small paragraph is written out. And so that's the origin, but it's interesting that you're now, why are you so interested in that? But it's like, it's the description of that. She is unable to say what it all is that makes her a different person, or that makes her, she can't bridge. She can't bridge in her narration the distance. And there's a lack of language for that. But at the same time, the interest is also really nothing else, nothing more simple than that there is a need for a structure, that there is a need for a break, that there is a need for a moment where you are not, where you can't bear anything else anymore, and where there needs to be a pause. And that also that there is the need of the ability to experience a pause.
Another interesting aspect of a sculptural language is the subtle use of the space she gently occupies with her works. No pedestals, and a certain gravity to bring the viewer's eyes down to the floor.
I think that has a lot to do with how we position ourselves in towards the world and how we mediate things. And as soon as the objects are presented on a pedestal, you take the presence of your body away. It is like very much only for your eyes. And in the moment you place things on the ground, you are confronted with your own body and you are confronted with your own being in the space. And what my hope is, or my interest is, like that through this position on the floor, also like the viewer is experiencing certain changes in himself or herself. And it is definitely like, the moment things are on the floor, it's very immediate. It's a very simple approach. It is the way how children are playing in their room or outside, or it's how things are presented on a market. And it's I wish they are like objects that you can use and place also, and that they help you to direct a space or to direct yourself inside of a space.
Papier-mâché, along with cloth, cardboard, blankets, found objects. The use of leather is again functional to the discourse around our ability to sense and communicate information and emotion.
The leather was mainly used as, interestingly, as eyes, so they were representing a part of the body that normally is not covered by skin. It was closing something. But it is about, again, about the limit, a border, the transitional border of the, and then how far this border is described, informed by the senses. And it's a play of the which information we receive and the space that is created through that, through this information. Like in the recent work, this fabric that is covered with two ears from both sides of the fabric, there is an ear applied to it, but there's literally no space between the ears, so the sound can't go anywhere. It's like, and that how far in these eyes are blind, and these ears, there's no space where this the sound can live. So this again is talking about an maybe an inability also to sense certain things, or to perceive, or to read, or to hear certain information, or certain emotions and feelings, or the inability to express them.
At the end, by persisting in talking about denied, impossible, difficult communication, the question is how far she goes in skepticism about our ability to hold a proper exchange, a safe exchange with individuals and the surrounding space.
It's a huge question, but I think the possibilities are very limited. No, it's also not true. There is the limitation is about the understanding. So what I put in question is kind of the certainty of the assumption to be understood. And maybe it's a way to describe the fragility of this process and the labor, the work of that. But at the same time, I also absolutely believe into the... If I wouldn't believe into the possibility, there would be, of course, no reason and no to do what I'm doing. And the choice is maybe representing the same fragility or uncertainty of being understood, of communication, of the option of expression. Like, if you look at the work, there is not, like, it is a fairly positive work. Like, it is a fairly entertaining work, maybe even. Like, you, there's a lot of, there's humor, there's subtlety, there is, there's a joy. And that's also, there's a joy of using the material, there's a joy of experience the material, and a joy of play there. But at the same time, I think it is always, there's this question of the possibility where this leads to and is present. Like, yeah.
This conversation was recorded at Villa Romana, December 2013.